It's Oliver Wong from Heat Rocks with another mini episode answering your mailbag questions. And this particular episode was inspired by a question from Sandeep Singh Chauhan, one of our audience members up in British Columbia. Shout out to Sandeep. He wanted us to chop up a specific sample. And if we're going to go down that path, I had to reach out and get a sampling expert on the line to join me for this one. That's one of People Under the Stairs. You all, of course, should already know his name because he created our theme song, and he also taped an episode for our sampling series talking about Nas's Illmatic. Thess is social distancing from his home in the South Bay, where I assume he's homeschooling, prepping meals in a wood-fired brick oven, and working out some kind of magic in the studio, as always. Thess, thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, man. Good to be here. I am currently in lockdown, but I'm transmitting live from the studio.
Now, I asked you what you would consider to be a fun or at least interesting sample to dig into, and especially one that many folks have used in different ways. And I love the choice that you came up with, which was Quincy Jones's Summer in the City. Originally recorded and released in 1973 as the first song on Jones's number one jazz charting album, You've Got It Bad Girl, Summer in the City is a mostly instrumental cover of the hit 1966 song by the Lovin' Spoonful.
Hot town, summer in the city, back of my neck getting dirt and gritty. Bend down, isn't it a pity, doesn't seem to be a shadow in the city. All around, people looking half dead, walking on the sidewalk harder than a match head.
Jones lined up a murderer's row of session musicians, including organist Eddie Lewis, electric pianist Dave Grusin, drummer Grady Tate, and on bass, it's either Chuck Rainey or Carol Kaye or maybe both on this song. Best as we know, it was first sampled in 1991 by the proto-trip-hop group Nightmares on Wax. And most recently was flipped in 2020 by producers Pop Wenzel and Bobby Blanco for the song Numb by Philly's Brianna Cash. Thess, why did this song, of all the different samples you could have chosen from, why did this one come to mind for you?
It's first of all, I feel like it's weather appropriate. Because it's starting to heat up here and there.
Very much, yeah.
But I think it's an interesting choice because from a hip hop producer perspective, Quincy Jones is, as a music producer, I would say hugely influential to hip hop producers, a really important missing link when it comes to taking the role of the producer out of the like Phil Spector and in that sort of era and fast forwarding and going all the way forward to where we are now. So I think it's interesting to use a song where Quincy Jones is in a sense taking an original song and putting his spin on it like a producer would. But then also his link to all of us as a producer. And then as far as the actual record goes, you know, it was Quincy Jones was coming out of this era where jazz was jazz and pop was pop. And here we have something where he's like taking this killer lineup of jazz musicians and creating a very sort of pop radio friendly thing. It was, I know when you go back and you read like Downbeat and things from that era, the Quincy Jones records like this, the CTI records were looked at as sort of this just sellout jazz. But it also marks an important transition, which then would lead to hip hop, because out of that transition, we get the Summer in the City. We get, you know, Bob James 1 and 2, and we get all of these vastly important jazz pop records that became the foundation for hip hop's breakbeats and samples and everything. So it's, I feel like it's a good linchpin record. It ties together a lot of different decades, and it's been used, you know, I didn't even think it had been used that many times. If I had to guess, I would have said maybe 15 or 20, but that's a lot of times on record it's been used.
We'll come back to that point in just a moment, but could you just elaborate a little bit more in terms of talking about how you see Quincy Jones's approach and how he produced the song as being akin to sort of how we think of production in, let's say, a post-hip-hop context.
Yeah, you know, I think what Quincy's doing with the song from a structural standpoint is really interesting. I think whenever hip-hop producer starts sampling, right, they're thinking about that moment where it's either a one bar loop or a two bar loop. So one bar would be like just, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, and then back again to the top. And this song in particular has a lot of very blatant, like, you can't miss them.
Yeah.
Loops. You know what I mean? Like you're listening to the song and there's this moment where you're just like, there it is. I want to hear that two bars over and over and over and over and over again. It's easy. I mean, starting with the very beginning of the song, you know, it just hits you right in the head. What he was doing there, in a sense, was he was creating all of these moments in the song. But what Quincy does is then he breaks out of it violently in the way that the song transitions and has all these different key changes. It moves with like determination. It's a beautiful piece of production. Yeah. The way that it's so bold how it changes on a dime, and it's unapologetic about it. And I think that's what creates these really great aha like hip hop loops. When I'm listening to a record and I'm looking for a part to sample, it's not just the notes that we're always looking for. A lot of times you're looking for a texture. And sometimes when a producer chops things up into oblivion, really all that's left is the texture and they're representing that. And so certain producers from back in the day, like a Quincy Jones or David Axelrod or people who are known for being sampled, they really create a really tangible texture to the music by their use of effects, by their use of reverb and space and miking. And it creates this really palpable piece, chunk of music that you can loop and listen to over and over again. And so when you listen to like Electric Prunes, you know, Release of an Oath, and you hear that, like you can hear the loop, but you can also feel this texture to it. When you hear the Hammond organ come in on Summer in the City, it's this steamy, like the organ sounds like it's sweating. It takes me to a stoop in New York with fans blowing and someone hanging out the window and just sweating. And it's that sweaty texture that he was able to give to it that accentuates the topic matter. And that's where the producer becomes an artist. That's where he transcends the typical role of the guy sitting behind the glass and telling the musicians what to do and managing the session and really puts his stamp on it. And Quincy was known for that. I mean, he did it on Thriller, you know, he did it here. And so you say, well, how could a guy make something sound steamy or spooky or whatever? He did it. He knows how to do it. He knows how to bring those emotions out of the players and the music.
Which is a great point. I think it might explain why, as you were saying just a moment ago, why it's been sampled so many times. And on that note, like you, I knew it had been used a few times, but then when I looked it up on who sampled, this song has been used at least 74 different times, which completely blew my mind. Because in my experience, songs that yield over, let's say, a dozen or so samples, it's almost always songs that have drum breaks in it, because you can do a lot with a drum break. But it's to me, much more unusual for a single song to yield that many uses when it's primarily the melodic elements that folks are coming back to time and time again. So what do you think that's about? What, I mean, I guess you've already touched on this, certainly in terms of talking about the texture, right, that Jones right. brought to this. But what is it
about? Why so many times?
and why this song? Yeah.
Well, I think, so as hip-hop evolved, and you can really track this, but I used to spend an enormous amount of time nerding out over this, and you and I have talked about a lot. There's a lot of theory that's, I think, unexplored when it comes to sample-based music. And one of the things I've always kicked around in my head is that, you know, there was in the infancy of hip-hop, as producers were looking to, you know, when it got beyond ultimate breaks and beats, and when it got beyond guys going back and forth with a predefined set of records that were used in the disco era, and producers were looking for something more, the first thing they usually turned to were the records that were in their parents' record collection. And when you read, you know, interviews with hip-hop producers from back in the day, it always comes back to, well, I went and raided my parents' record collection. And there's even this really famous scene one of my favorite scenes in this, you know, cult classic for me at least, movie called Fly By Night, where the guy, you know, they're looking for the hot new loop, and they go and they take their dad's records, and then they come back and the dad gets all mad.
Okay, you stay away from my records, you hear me? Don't go near my records.
Yo, chill out, Dad, you got some deaf shit here.
You put that down, put it down. Stretch them all up, and then I can't play them.
This is a record that if your parents were even remotely hip, it was in their collection. So I think it's important to start there and say, look, this was a really accessible record. It sold, I don't know what the sales figures are, but I can assume it's in every dollar bin. I mean, it's this record was a huge hit. And so you're a producer and you're like, you're getting your chops up and you're listening to your parents' records. And here it is, like, here's this song with these big loops that just hit you over the head. Like, you don't have to be a genius to loop this up. It's right there. And I think there's a certain amount of nostalgia too. Like, a lot of people, they remember their parents listening to it, so they want to sample it. And yeah. And you know, it's there's other examples. I think when you look at how hip hop grew, you hear a lot of, you know, all those James Brown loops. A lot of that was because that's what people had, their parents had in their record collection. Same thing with all those Roy Ayers loops. It was like, a lot of these things were laying around, and we kind of overlook them now as being common, but they really were how a lot of producers, the library that a lot of producers inherited was this Quincy Jones and Roy Ayers and, you know, just this sort of pop jazz stuff that was accessible.
Just to make sure I'm not misunderstanding you, but I seem to recall that when we did our Illmatic episode together, you completely tried to demolish the idea of the, oh, I raided my parents' record collections, to say that, nah, these fools were spending like a shit ton of money at record conventions and paying private dealers to get their hands on stuff to sample, as opposed to like,
yes.
Oh yeah, my uncle had 300 records and I grew up in going to his
no,
attic.
Yeah. I did break that down, because again, you look at Illmatic. Illmatic is the full extension of the arms race, or the race to the moon for producers. And it would not have been acceptable. It would have not have been, in my opinion, again, I wasn't one of the producers on Illmatic, but knowing the record dealers who were supplying them or whatever, they would have laughed their ass off if someone showed up with a beat for Illmatic using Quincy Jones' Summer in the City. That's just baby stuff here. This is foundational stuff. They were Hail Mary. They were sending it deep. And so by the time you evolve out of your parents' record collection, yeah, the ultimate extension of that is paying $300, $400, and $700 for a record at a record convention so that you can be the first producer to use it. But, you know, when the Far Side used this, we're talking about something a little bit more like, you know, L.A.J. and the other producers working on the record, they weren't like known producers. It wasn't an arms race, you know, like they were just grabbing stuff that fit well. And I mean, I think Passing Me By is as effective as it is because there's so much tension there, and there's so, and it is so familiar, and it's so sweaty, and it just, that it really captures the mood of the song, just in the same way that Quincy Jones captured the Summer in the City. So yeah, no, you're right. I mean, like, you know, Illmatic, maybe they could have gotten away with this, but as a point of pride, none of those producers were gonna pull this record out, I feel like.
The Farside were not the first to sample the song, as best we know. Certainly, actually, I think that's for the historical record. They were not the first.
They were not, no.
But I do not think it's debatable that their use of it on Passing Me By was the first and arguably best known example for the general public. Do you think Farside opened the floodgates, or do you think this song, meaning the Quincy Jones song, would have gotten sampled to death at some point no matter what, even if Farside had never existed or had never used it for Passing Me By?
It would have happened no matter what, because people would have been grabbing whatever records were laying around them, and, right. and inevitably people would have continued to sample the song. It's just that they were able, like I said previously, they were able to capture the vibe of the song so effectively that it became the most notorious use of the sample.
Got it.
But I don't think it would have been the first, nor would it have been the last.
To take this back to how not just Farside, but other groups have used Summer in the City, what stands out to me is how the vast majority of its uses are really from just two parts of the song. It's either the very beginning, which is what the Farside use, or it's from the second half of the first chorus, if that makes sense in terms of the song structure, roughly about 50 seconds in. This is how it sounds on the original song itself. And the first time I heard someone using that part of Summer in the City was for Black Moon's Reality, which both samples from that bridge and then filters that same part. Again, that 50 seconds in part, it filters it to make it into the primary kind of pseudo bass line in the Black Moon song. It was actually a bit of a challenge to find examples of producers using some other part of the song besides the very beginning or that second half of the first chorus. And out of the exceptions to the rule, I really liked what this group Too Rough, who I'd never heard of before, they did this on 1994's Every Day, All Day. I got styles upon styles. My title is heavyweight. I'm brutalizing for the rapper who draw the emissary. There's a lot else on the song people could have used.
Right.
Do you feel like there are a lot of missed opportunities?
I mean, I think, you know, we'll never know all the times people have used them, have used it. But I think, you know, there's been a lot of interesting uses. Like, for instance, if you look at how the Roots used it for the song Clones,
yeah,
which was like a big club banger. And then the bridge, or like the sort of relief section of Clones, is the bridge from the Quincy Jones song. It's funny because on the Roots song, it's pretty unnecessary. You know what I mean? Like, it just comes out of nowhere. It has nothing to do with the main part of the Roots song, but it's really effective in sort of giving a breath to their song.
Very.
And it's really effective in the Quincy Jones composition to give a breath before it swings back and it goes back to the main, you know, chord run. So I think it's really interesting how different producers interpret what Quincy was doing and then maybe inadvertently do the same thing with that. There's this one part at the end that's another real distinct loop. I don't know if anyone's used it. I know I used it back in the day, but it's the part where it's the girl goes...
Both you and I came of age listening to hip-hop at a time in which no biting allowed was a central part of the hip-hop ethos, right? And I always thought that the whole digging in the crates aspiration was supposed to be about finding new records that hadn't been used yet. But here we have examples, not just within, you know, 91, 92, but across the entire 90s into the 2000s, where Summer in the City has been used, you know, time and time again, you know, 74 times. And as we've been talking about, most of those cases are people using the exact same parts of the song, really just two parts of it. Do you think that says more about the appeal of Summer in the City, that producers were willing to return to something despite knowing how many other previous producers had used it? Or is this more of a case of producers just being, let's say, insufficiently original, to be generous?
I think, for instance, when the Roots used it, I almost feel like it was referential, like they were given a shout to it. You know what I mean? Like, everyone knew what it was at that point. Everyone knows when they hear it. I don't think that they were trying to be original with that. I think it was almost a nod. For other people, yeah, I mean, there may be a little bit of a lack of creativity. In my opinion, once the Far Side did what they did to that loop is off limits. It'd be like trying to redo the Mona Lisa again or something and seriously having a go at it. You can't. It's done. Move on. Nothing to see here.
So when you used it, did you use it after the Far Side? But oh, you used a different part than the Far Side.
I used a different part. Yeah. And I don't even remember. I don't remember if it was, I don't know. Nowadays, I don't remember. It's quarantine, man. I can't remember if I did it or someone else did it.
Got it. Well, speaking of stuff that you're working on, what are you working on right now?
Man, I've been doing a lot of gardening. And, I think you and I talked about this. I'm basically a part-time day trader at this point. And I'm still making music. But it's funny, like, I felt going into this, I didn't feel like going into the studio at all. And I started feeling really guilty about the fact that everyone on Instagram seemed like they were creating, and everyone was like expecting artists to sort of create and go live, and that this was this huge moment for art, for the arts community. And I didn't feel inspired. I felt depressed and upset, and I didn't feel like anything. And I was beating myself up for the fact that I couldn't be a part of this. But I think now, in retrospect, I think a lot of people were feeling like that, you know. And I think it's okay. So I've been getting back to music slowly, and just trying, as this new normal becomes normal, I think it's easier for me to make music again. But those first month where everyone was like, oh man, you're probably making like crazy stuff right now, I'm like, nah, man, I'm not. I'm just trying to live just like you, you know?
Well, good luck with that, both what you're growing in the garden and growing in the lab, as they say. And Thess, thank you so much for joining me on this today.
Yeah, man. Thanks. It's always a pleasure to talk music with you. And let's do it again. Let's talk about something else.
And real quick, where can people find your stuff online, or if they want to check out whatever you're working on?
I mean, yeah, people can follow me on Instagram at peacelock70, PIECELOCK70. Other than that, you know, there's a whole legacy of People Under the Stairs music out there. There's my instrumental work under Thess One. But I've been mostly offline, you know. I've been out in the garden, so we'll see. Maybe I'll open up a stand at the farmer's market, and I'll have, bro, I got crazy varieties of avocados. I got all these crazy citrus. It's kind of, you know, it's kind of jamming.
I'm going to hit you with a really bad hip-hop dad joke, but you should grow beets so you could show up at the farmer's market with fresh beets.
Fresh beets. Yeah. So way, way, way back, I think it was in 2008, on our album Carried Away, or 2009, I was watching The Office when The Office was like on live TV, and and there was this part where Dwight says, he's talking about his beet farm, and he says something to the effect of like, he's like, I only use the best beets. He's like, I call these the money beets. And and I dropped it in as an interlude back then. It was funny because it didn't feel like The Office. I don't think a lot of people got it at the time, because The Office hadn't really become like the cult thing that it is now.
Yeah.
And so now my son wanted a Dunder Mifflin sweatshirt. That was like his big stylistic movement going back to school this winter. And I'm like, yeah, man, you know, I used to sample The Office. Where he don't care. He's like, you're old.
First rule in beat sales, put the most attractive beats on top. The ones that make you pull the car over and go, wow, I need this beat right now. Those are the money beats.
Once again, my thanks to Theswin for joining me today. Thanks again to Sandeep for his question that instigated this. I really found it to be a very enjoyable conversation. I hope you all did too. And keep your suggestions coming. You can leave notes on the Facebook Heat Rocks group or send me a line direct through my social media as you want. Easiest way to reach me would be through soul-sides.com. And until next time, I'm Oliver Wong for Heat Rocks.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.